So this is our last edition of 2019. Oh, we can all be sad. So sad, so sad. But next Wednesday is the Maine Kids Christmas program. It'll start at 6:30 in the sanctuary. There's a little drama piece that's going to go first. Then first, second, third, and fourth graders will all ring. And then we will end with the pre-KK Christmas pageant. Everything should be done by like 7:05, 7:10, something along those lines. And then that'll be the last Wednesday night. Yes, ma'am.
How soon can grandparents go in and get a seat?
Have your babies. I think you could go in anytime. They, everybody's on regular schedule next week,
okay,
so 6 o'clock, okay. All is well. It is my favorite meal of the year, gingerbread waffle night. Do you want to come back for gingerbread waffle? It is so good. But pre-KK will, they usually have Chick-fil-A nuggets instead in their rooms because syrup isn't conducive to Christmas pageants. So I think they can get there earlier. But like 6 is when they for sure need to be there. But they won't eat in Fellowship Hall.
And they'll take them to their
and they'll take, everything will happen. Yeah. But I'll put it in an email on Tuesday to you with the for sure details. Because I forgot, they usually, they will eat in their room. So probably anytime after 5:30, between 5:30 and 6, drop them off so they have time to eat. First through fourth, do normal. Yeah.
But go. So they sing this Sunday too, right?
They sing this Sunday. Bonus points for who knows what time you pull into the parking lot. Yes, Heidi. 8:45. What do I have to give you? My undying love.
You're supposed to punch in and leave your kid at the foyer when somebody has noticed that you're leaving your kid at the foyer.
That's really good, really good. But not foyer, inside the sanctuary. So check them in, get their sticker. You're going to check them in for choir and Sunday school, and then you're going to take them and make sure a child care worker lays eyes on them before you hit the road. This is really great, y'all. Really great, really great. Any other questions about Sunday or next Wednesday? It's going to be adorable. The pageant next Wednesday will be broadcast. So I'll send you the link when we have the link.
On the internet?
On the internet,
the
Heidi.
Interwebs.
The interwebs.
It's going to go viral.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Any other questions about any of that? Are y'all set? Everybody set? Everybody feels good? All right. Well, let me introduce my very dear friend to y'all, Clayton Anderson, or you can call him Clay. Clay and I met when Anna Rader was born. So, right, she's going to graduate from college any minute. Y'all know that. So Clay and I go back just a little bitty tiny bit. He says mean things about me, but I was never mean to him, ever. Ever. What is that? What is that? But I did do my job, that's all.
Yes.
As you did your job as well.
Yes.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get started. And thank you so much for being here.
Thanks
and
for having me.
Can we go ahead and introduce Susan, too?
This is my beautiful bride, Susan Anderson. She is the director of protocol at the Johnson Space Center at NASA. She's been there almost 30 years.
Past
30 years. So she and I met. I stalked her.
You're gonna talk
I'm going to tell that.
Oh, you're going to talk about that in a minute. Don't talk about it yet.
My bad.
But thank you for coming, too, Susan. We're really happy to have y'all.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to generally cover three broad topics. One is space and what it's like to be an astronaut. The second is resilience and how important that is as a character trait. And the third is, I think it's just really interesting to talk to people like Clay about where their faith and their job intersect. So we're going to start with your superhero, Superman, and how close you got to be to Superman when you were actually flying in space.
So she's referring to a part of my book where I talk about, as a kid, we woke up every Saturday and we watched Superman, the Superman Aquaman Superhero Hour. Anybody remember that? Anybody old enough to remember that? And I love Superman. I'm a superhero guy all the way. Superman's my favorite, and it's kind of funny that I got to be both Aquaman and Superman. I lived underwater in a habitat off of Key Largo, Florida for about 3 weeks for some training activities. So every day we scuba'd, so I was Aquaman, right? All the animals, the fish, it was so cool. And then I went into space, and every day I tell people, what was it like to live in space? I was Superman every day. I woke up, I flew to breakfast, then I flew to work, and if I needed a break, I flew into the bathroom, and I flew while I was going to the bathroom. So, it's not like, I didn't have X-ray vision. That would have been really cool, but I really didn't have much to look at. So, but that's kind of the, every day was a joy to be in space.
So tell us, like, about your space career, what it was like, how many flights you flew, all that kind of good
okay.
stuff.
I came to the Houston area in 1981 as a summer intern for the Johnson Space Center. I had gotten that job kind of by happenstance from Hastings College in Nebraska, if you've ever heard of Hastings College. Very small school, but it turns out that a guy that worked in Building 30 at the Johnson Space Center in 1981 had graduated from Hastings College in 1961. And was an alum, and he came to pheasant hunt every fall in Nebraska. So he comes up to pheasant hunt. He actually hunts with the guidance counselor from Hastings College. They get to shoot in the breeze. Hey, what do you do? I'm from NASA. Oh, hey, we got a kid who loves NASA. Oh, yeah, does he know we have an intern program? No, I don't think he does. Well, I can send him the stuff. And so they sent me the stuff. I applied. I had a phone interview back then. That's all you got. And they selected me as one of 40. So 1981, I started my first internship. I would come back the next summer. In 82, they offered me full-time employment in 83, and the rest is history. I spent 15 years as an astronaut, or as an engineer, and 15 years as an astronaut. So I became the first summer intern in the history of NASA to make it to outer space. Yeah. I flew twice. I went up on Atlantis, and they shoved me through the hatch, and I was a sack of potatoes, and I then would spend 148 days on the International Space Station before I would come home with Discovery, the crew of Discovery. So back then, we had a deal where American astronauts went up on the shuttle with a shuttle crew, but you were a station resident, so they shoved you through, and then you brought home the old station person. And then I stayed, and then a new crew came up with a new station guy, and he and I swapped out, and I went home. So I was up for a total of 152 days the first time. Up on Atlantis, down on Discovery, and then I would fly again 3 years later on STS-131, which is a shuttle-dedicated mission to take supplies back to the space station. That was about 15 days long, and over those two missions, I did 6 spacewalks. So I've had it's been a great run, a great ride, and got to do a lot of things.
What was your expedition number?
Expedition 15. So Dolores, or DOE, as we called her at NASA. DOE was the training lead for Expedition 1. And I met her around that time, right when I was a baby astronaut, and then I would not fly
until... We called them that, too, like
yes.
The baby astronauts.
Well, most of them acted like babies.
Not
me.
You. Never.
I was very mature for my age. But my expedition was 15, so and I went from being assigned, I had multiple assignments. I was on 13, then I was on 14, and then I was on 15, and then I became 15 and 16. But we had shuttle training leads, so Dolores was the first one, the first space station training lead. And then I would get mine later. But while she was training her Expedition 1 crew, baby astronauts, we had jobs, and we helped the crews that were either in space or getting ready to fly in space. So I spent a lot of time working with Dolores' crew, figuring out things. Because if you think about this, those guys had never been on a space station before, and we had nothing. We had no procedures. We didn't know how to do anything. So baby astronauts like me were in the simulators trying to figure out how to write all this down to tell the crew what to do. And that meant if a fire broke out or if the station sprung a leak. I mean, lots of serious stuff, but then lots of mundane stuff. And I did most of the mundane stuff.
What question do y'all have for Clay about working, living, flying in space?
Oh, I pooped in 4 different spaceships.
That's not a big source of pride.
Would you like me to name them? Sir?
One of the most difficult part of being out there that long of a period, the biggest adaption?
For me, is being away from my wife and kids. So,
huh?
Well, I got hugs from Fyodor and Oleg, but it just wasn't the same. And, you know, when you saw Oleg coming at you after his workout clothes on, you wanted to be as far away from him as absolutely possible. But in order to fly on the station, you have to train. And I had to train a long time in Russia. I spent 3.5 years training to fly. And every other month, basically, was a month in Russia, a month in Houston, a month in Russia, a month in Houston. And that's hard. That was really hard for me. Because when Susan and I decided it was okay to say we were going to do this, the kids were 6 years old and 2 years old. And so when the car pulls up in front of your house for your next month in Russia, and your little girl is two, and she's grabbing on your leg, and she's crying and saying, "Daddy, don't go," that's a tough thing to deal with. And then you turn to my beautiful bride here, who had to assume the responsibility for everything. You know, and I'm indebted to her, because for me, it's easy to tell people like you that I did not do this by myself. Some of my colleagues are not so ready to say that, but I did not do this without her. She gave up a lot of her career. She went on part-time work at NASA so she could take care of the kids and take them where they needed to be. So all that starts with my kids 6 and 2, and then when I finally got to fly, my son was 10 and my daughter was 6. So, you know, that's a long time. And then it was scary for them because the Columbia accident had happened, and we'll probably talk a little bit about that. But then when I went the second time, they were 14 and 10, and that went a long way to make it easy for them to let Dad go. So that was the hardest, kids, family.
Todd, we're going to let you ask a question, but while we're on that topic, will you explain to everybody, like, what's the size of the space station? When you said you were there with Oleg and,
oh,
like, kind of give them a sense of, like, who's there?
There was three of you?
Three of us, yes. So back then, crews were three. There were two for a while when Columbia happened. They went down to two people. But when I flew, and for a long time after that, it was three. Now it's six. But imagine that the space station is, at that time, was about three school buses long, or three Greyhound buses maybe long. Each module is about 15 feet, or 60 feet long and 15 feet in diameter. But you have all the stuff you need to keep you alive, so the living space is smaller. But it was awesome. It was not too small for me. It was not too big for me. I had places I could go to get away from those guys if I needed to get away. My sleep station was the size of a telephone booth. So every night, I opened the door to my telephone booth, and I flew in, and I got into my sleeping bag and in my boxer shorts, and that's all I wore, boxer shorts only. And I stuck my hand through the holes and zipped it up and went to sleep. And my sleep station was also my private space a lot, right? I did a lot of crying in there, and I did a lot of soul searching in there when stuff would happen. So, but one of the coolest things about living with those two men was those two men. It's really hard to describe how you become one with two guys from Russia. And we didn't train very much together because I was telling you I was on Expedition 12, and then I was on Expedition 13, then I got moved to 14, and then I was on 15 finally. And we didn't train together very much. But thank God, they were both parents. They had kids the same age as mine. Fyodor had two daughters. Oleg had a son and a daughter. Each of them were 6 and 2-ish, 6 and 3-ish. So I loved it. And the Russian media called us the Tri Kosmicheski Brati, the three space brothers. And then the other thing they like to refer to us as Tri Mushketiri na Orbite, the three musketeers in space. And I love those guys. I would do anything I could for them. I would hope they'd feel the same way about me, but it's really hard when they live in Russia and I live in Houston. But
you speak Russian?
Извините, пожалуйста, я не слышу.
You have to, right, Clay?
Yeah, you have to know. I mean, my Russian sounds a lot better than it is. There were way better Russian-speaking astronauts than me. But in order to fly on the Soyuz, which is the lifeboat, right? I flew up on the shuttle, down on the shuttle. I lived on the space station. All that's independent, for the most part, of a Russian Soyuz until something happens and you have to abandon ship. So just like you're on Royal Caribbean and you get in their little lifeboats when they drop them down on the water, that's your Soyuz. And what the Russians did was smartly for money-wise, right? Nothing in the Soyuz is in English. Nothing. Everything in the station is in English, but nothing in the Soyuz. So you better know enough to get by. And, of course, as poor as my Russian language was, I was smart enough to know that I was grabbing Oleg by the back of his pants and I was not letting go. I mean, as an astronaut, some of us think we're so smart that we can learn more than the Russians. I'm not that way. Those guys, it's their native language, their native engineering. They know it way better than I'll ever know it. And so I grabbed his butt, and I was going to hang on till he told me what to do or to let go.
And how much Russian language training did you take?
Lots. Yeah, I started doing my job as an engineer, and I took Russian language because it was offered. I could go four times a week for an hour. Pretty easy. And she worked for the Russian Mir Space Station Shuttle Phase 1 program. So she was hauling me off to places all the time with a bunch of Russian dudes. And, you know, I'm a people guy. And so I start talking to these dudes, and they just look at you. So then I decided, well, this would be cool. And I started to learn Russian, and I have a little bit of affinity, I've been told, for languages. So it was easy in Russia, or it was easy in America. I hated it in Russia. So imagine you come to your Russian language class. You have 4 hours every Monday and every Wednesday. And you come up the stairs in this old dark building with just windows on one side at the top, little windows. And the only thing in the room is a table, two chairs, and a whiteboard. And your instructor. And my instructor was named Vladimir Baldushkin. And he was about this tall. And he wore an ascot every day. And he was a lovely man, but I hated Russian. I'd get 2 hours in the morning, then I'd ride my bike back to the cottages where we live for lunch, and I'd stretch every second before I had to ride back and not be late, and then I'd trudge up those stairs, and I'd have 2 hours in the afternoon. And then we did that twice a week. And he used to pound on the table. Clay, I want to kill you. That's what he said.
And you weren't sure. Like, maybe he really did. You don't know. You don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Todd.
I'm curious about the flight up the shuttle. Uh-huh. The rocket, and then coming back down through the atmosphere. Explain, and how precise is it? I mean, is it?
It's just a wag. Getting to space takes 8.5 minutes. Rendezvousing with the space station took us 2 more days. We could do it in a day, but we took 2 days. And, you know, the first 2 minutes of the shuttle launch have the solid rocket motors, the big white stacks on the side, and those are solid, so they're very rough. And it's very dynamic. It's like being on the greatest roller coaster ride ever invented. And I didn't ride on the flight deck where the windows are. I rode on the mid deck where there's nothing except a couple astronauts sitting in chairs. But you hear it, you feel it. I mean, it's incredible. And the first time, I was wetting my pants. I was, you know, having issues, and I was freaking out. The second time was way cooler because I watched everybody else wet their pants and freak out. But once you get, the cool thing is the first 2 minutes are really rough, then they fall off. And then it's pretty smooth, but you're accelerating. You're getting heavier and heavier and heavier. So you weigh 3 times your body weight, roughly. And then you finally get to the point where the engine shut off, and you hear this, and you're weightless, and stuff starts to float around you. And that is 8.5 minutes. Yeah. And then coming home, it's a little more dynamic. It's kind of like being on a United Airlines flight. You have no leg room, no, their seat's hard as a rock. There's crappy service, you know, but... You know, and it flames, it gets really hot in the cabin, and you think you're going to yak chunks all over everything, but then you land, and it was pretty cool after 152 days.
Did your ears pop?
Yeah, all that's just like getting in an airplane. We just go a little higher.
So how long does it take you to get back?
About an hour. Because you undock, and you have to do some maneuvers to get away from the space station, and then eventually you'll get in an orbit where you're safe to fire your engines that are going to slow you down enough to be grabbed by gravity again. And once gravity grabs you, you're coming home pretty soon. And that's when things really start happening. But it's kick butt. Can't beat it with a stick.
Michelle.
You lift off, but you docked up. How long was that period?
2 days.
2 days.
Yeah.
Michelle.
I'm just curious, part of your training as an astronaut, is there a psychological component?
No. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. Have you read my book? The Ordinary Spaceman from Boyhood Dreams to Astronaut? Chapter 12? There is and there isn't. So when I finally knew I was going to space, you have briefings with the psych guys. And that's what it shows up on your schedule as. Psych guy. 30 minutes, an hour, whatever it was. It was never more than an hour. And the first time I met with my psych guy, I had a great guy. His name was Gary Bevan. I love him to death. I still love him today. He and I went through a lot. And if you read my book, you'll find out what we went through. But he and I went through a lot. But there was another guy. So they have three of them. At the time, they had three of them, right? Because he's a military, so he traveled a lot, and he spoke at prisons a lot and dealt with prison population. So they gave me a substitute. His substitute was a, I don't want to use a bad word, but I didn't like him very much. Because he gave me a briefing, and all they do is throw charts in front of you, right? And he said, and his line to me was, you better take care of yourself because nobody else is going to care about you. That was my psych briefing. And then they ended up calling my wife in after we had a couple issues that we dealt with and told her that she needed to grow thicker skin. So when you think about astronauts going on to Mars and six to nine months to get there and staying there for a year and coming back for 6 to 9 months, we haven't solved that problem yet. But astronauts think they're so smart and so talented and so capable, we can do anything. Yeah, it'll be easy.
I would think that aspect of it would be neglected in favor of sort of the more science.
It is. But part of that rationale is, every day if I got frustrated, I could look out the window and I could see Earth. And that goes a long way to helping your mental stability. But now imagine you're in a capsule going to Mars, and after like 3 days, you turn around, you can't even see Earth anymore. All you get is deep space. And you have a crewmate that every time they talk to you, they get right in your space. I mean, wouldn't that drive you crazy? So, you know, no, we don't really get. I don't think, Dolores may know more, but in my experiences, they never really talked about compatibility of crew. It's more, can the guy do a spacewalk? Can he fly the robotic arm? Does he know how to take somebody's temperature? Those kind of skills, not how does he work with her or she work with him.
Because NASA was really, our manned spaceflight program was born from short duration. Like, so we went from shuttle to space station. And so a 7-day, 10-day, 14-day flight.
You can deal with anything.
It's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different. So this is a great segue. Will you talk to us about how you got to this picture?
Oh. So that's 1998. That's the Penguin class, the group, 17th group of astronauts ever selected. There were 31 of us at the beginning, but then we added a Canadian named Bob Thirsky. He's in there somewhere. Yeah, that's Bjarne. Bob may not be.
Everybody looks so young in this picture to me.
Where is he?
Where is he?
No, that's Leo. So he's not in it yet. So anyway, I think if you count, you'll get 31. But we had 32 because they added a Canadian late. But we all reported in August of 1998 after we'd all been selected. And there were several of us from NASA Johnson, but most of them were military. Most of them were from places unknown. They're all way smarter. So you see where I am up here? So as you go this way and this way, the IQ really goes way up. So he played football in the NFL. Well, he got drafted by the Lions, but he punched out for injury. But he has that going for him. Brazil, France. Let's see. Oh, yeah, the president of Texas A&M Galveston, where is he? Right here. Mayor of Friendswood is right here. Italy, Canada. Paolo Nespoli, he's a special forces from Italy. He kills people. Germany. Patty. Bless her heart. Patty died before she ever got to fly. She was a private pilot, and she was an experimental plane pilot. And she was flying with a guy in his experimental plane, and they crashed in Manville, and they caught on fire, and bless her heart, she died. This is Barb Morgan, who was backup for Krista McAuliffe, who died in Challenger. So then Barb fought like crazy to become a real astronaut, not just a publicity thing. And so she flew one time. Anybody else of note? He's the one that got booted out for... So you remember the girl that put on the diaper and drove with pepper spray to Florida? Well, this is the guy she was hot for. And
so much drama.
And he had the hots for her, but he also had the hots for another girl in the military, and so that's who she drove to spray pepper spray. And so let's see. Any other great story? Oh,
Sonny, you have to have a great...
This guy, Ferguson's going to be the first one for Boeing. He was an astronaut who's now a commercial astronaut for Boeing to fly their Starliner and flew the last shuttle as commander. And then this is my sister, space sister, right here. So Sonny Williams was Expedition 14, and so I was her backup because I was Expedition 15. So we did a lot of training together. We did a lot of things together. Sonny would always look at me and she'd say, "You got to do this. You're my backup." And I got into some, like the trip to St. Petersburg. That was rough, but I did it because I was her backup. That was the first time I punched out a Russian dude. Actually, I elbowed him in the mouth at about 5 in the morning on the streets of St. Petersburg because they were trying to rob us, but they were just young kids. So, you know, but experiences that are great stories. But Sunny's still an astronaut. She's getting ready to fly. She's going to fly on, one of the Boeing people. So she'll fly on the Boeing Starliner. And she's a helicopter pilot from the Navy. I danced with her mom. That's our big deal. When her mom came down for something, she and I danced, and her mother remembers that. And then her mother gave me a St. Christopher's medal to take into space that I wore religiously every day. It's in a museum in Ashland, Nebraska now. I lost it once in the station, and thank goodness for... air vents that sucked it up, and I found it like a snake just moving by an air vent. So I was real... I'd lost it for 24 hours, and I was really hurt. I was psychologically... And who'd have thought, right? But
so I already told him it took you more than one shot to get here. Tell us about that.
Took me... I was rejected 14 times and got picked on the 15th try. So that's not really fair in that you have to apply every time. Every time NASA, every year, you have to apply. NASA does not select every year, but you don't know when they're going to select and when they're not. So you have to update your application. So my first one went in 1983, and I wasn't quite eligible yet because I didn't have enough work experience. But I put it in anyway, and then I'd put my application in every year after that, and I didn't even get a sniff until my 13th year. And they invited me in for an interview. I didn't get selected. That was the class of 96. I flew with several of them. But then I applied in year 14, and then in year 15, I got an interview again and was selected. So, but people say, what's it like to apply to be an astronaut? I say, applying's easy. Getting selected's hard. So, I persevered. But
yeah, tell us, who instilled in you that sense of resilience or perseverance, or how did you discover that about yourself?
That's a great question because I'm not sure I know the answer. My role model, you know, people always ask you, who are your role models? Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin? No. My dad and my mom. And, you know, it might come from my mom, who went back to school to get her master's degree in speech pathology. And when we were growing up as kids, she was going to school. We spent a lot of time with our grandparents because she had to take us to grandma and grandpa's. She'd go into school and do her thing, come pick us up, and then we'd go home. And my dad had three heart attacks before he was 32. So he was not in great shape cardiovascularly. And he gave up a lot of jobs because he took a job at the State Highway Department in Nebraska for the sole reason that it provided him medical insurance, medical benefits to protect his family. So I think those traits to me are kind of what defined me, that my mom would do that. And then that my dad, back in those days, my dad would let her, right? I mean, that wasn't always to let her go to school, to pay for it, to know that she was going to make more money than him. Those were things that you didn't always see a lot of. And so that showed me a lot about who my father was, and it showed me a lot about who my mother was. And I remember when I was a summer intern in 1981, I was at home, and we had a little table by the front door where the mail came, and we always stacked the mail there, right? And I remember looking at, my dad had opened his pay stub, and he just set it back down, and I probably shouldn't have, but I looked at it one day. And my summer intern's salary was more than my father was making at his full-time job. And he'd worked there for over 30 years. But he never said anything. He knew what I made, but he never said anything to me about that. And that always, I knew he was proud, but the fact that he never mentioned it, you know, showed me a lot about who he was, about his character. And I apologize if I get emotional about the stuff. It's pretty important.
How many siblings do you have, and do you think we'll eventually get to Mars?
I have a sister who's 2 years older than me, a brother who's a year younger than me. They're both in Nebraska. Will we get to Mars? Sure, someday. Your little siblings might. See, I don't have a lot of full faith and confidence in the United States government these days. But I watch Elon Musk and some of these other folks, and so maybe we can do it. It's just that it's so expensive. And, you know, when you're fighting wars and you're building walls and you're, you know, dealing with Medicare for All and the Green New Deal and all those sort of things, that stuff costs money. And space is sometimes an afterthought. Even though your cell phone and your invisible braces and grandma's artificial hip and center pivot irrigation systems, GPS, all that stuff comes from basically from NASA technology spinoffs.
So will you share, or maybe Susan wants to share, like, so one of the things that I always have prayed for my girls is like this sense of grit and resilience, because their life is pretty easy. Like, mm-hmm. they don't have a lot of tough things that Steve or I, either one, maybe went through. How have y'all instilled or modeled or taught, like, how does that look for the Anderson family?
You want to try first?
Well, I think faith was always really important for us. And even when the church that we were attending didn't provide what we needed for our children, we found a way to find a program that was available to our children. So that was hugely important to us throughout their childhood, was to make sure that they were raised in the faith. So I think that helped a lot. With our son, his real resilience, I think, started because he was an athlete, and the rejection that you receive from coaches, where are you good, where are you not, what do you love, and then the rejection you get even when you love something and you're okay at it. And then injuries and injury prone. Those are a lot of things that were tough for him to overcome, and still working on that. Daughter, I think the hardest thing, well, and Cole was a big kid in middle school, so he took a lot of punishment from others. But that also was the case with Sutton, our daughter. Was how mean people are.
Yeah.
Even to this day, as an 18-year-old college freshman,
That's a tough. That you know, you don't. You can give them everything, but you, you developing that toughness to overcome mean people. It takes your faith and your and your trust yeah. in what God wants you to do. And that it's really hard to have those discussions and just let them go and not have not feel like well how do you solve those problems? How do you help your children through that? And so that's the one thing I can say that we rely on. And then even in church, some of the things that our daughter discovered weren't so great in high school, but now she's returning to the faith as a freshman because she's found some place to be that makes her feel good.
They've welcomed her. Yeah.
And so, yeah, she was like, I talked to her today, and she was all excited about going back to this church. And it was just because somebody invited her to be included. They heard her singing, and this her resident assistant heard her singing and said, would you come and sing at my church? And that's what it took for her to return to wanting to be a part of that. So I don't know if I answered your question per se, but that's just a little bit about their, you know, they've had to be resilient. And as you can see, she's in theater, and there's a lot of rejection in theater. you have to rise up above that.
So we hope, you know, through living our examples, we've tried to give them a good example. But like Dolores says, it's our kids have it easy. I mean, you know, I make a better living than my parents ever did, right? So when my kids needed stuff and, or, you know, when it was time to have a car to drive, you know, I gave my son my truck. And, of course, he was happy until he learned, you know, that he was going to keep the truck for about 12 years. anyone so excited anymore. But, you know, it's just, it's a different time for them. And he was a pretty good athlete and a pretty good football player, and he got a full ride to play at Iowa State. And when he got to Iowa State, when his second year was going to happen and things were looking really good for him to play a lot, he tore his right knee. And then he sat out that year. The coaches all got fired. The new guys come in, and they don't care about him because he's hurt. He fights his way back, and he starts, and he is an academic All-American, and then in the spring game, he tore his left knee, right? So now he's got another year to go through this, right? Well, now they look at him and they say, well, he's injury prone. We don't care about him at all. So how does a kid that, you know, his whole life was sports and football deal with that? And did we give him the weapons he needs to, or the tools, I guess, not weapons. Yeah, I don't really like one of the coaches, but
yeah. So yeah, I mean, and everybody, every family has
the same.
They
yes,
have their things, but I think resilience is something that you develop over time.
Yeah,
and then you have to depend on your family and your family of faith to help you get through it all.
Yep. So I was involved in church my whole life from.
You played the organ, y'all.
Yeah, I was an organ. Yeah, and when I grew up in my hometown, my sister was older. She played the piano, and then I came up and played the organ. So we played together, and then she graduated. Then I moved over to the piano. My brother came up and he played the organ, and then I graduated, and then. So we had a lot of that, and we were very involved. We were taught at an early age. My mom used to say, it's your obligation. But she was right, and, you know, we did a lot of things through the church, and it taught me that, you know, watching people of faith helped me grow in faith. Now, then I got to college, and, you know, it's a different time in your life, and I got away from it a little bit. But then when I went to graduate school at Iowa State, that's where I went to school, I found church again. And the way I found it was I went back to church and I found out their high school chorus needed a piano player. And so I started playing the piano for these high school kids at this church in Iowa, in Ames, Iowa, and I loved it. And I was hooked again. And when I came back down to Houston, I met some people that I lived with for a short time who were at Arcadia Baptist Church. And of course, for me, the Baptist church was all about singing and the music leader and the microphone and the big songs and Steve Green and Sandy Patty and. Oh, man, I love that stuff. And so I started to sing more and play more. And then, you know, I've tried to keep it going. Am I the most faithful guy in the world? Probably not. But I believe. And when I got to space, I spent a lot of time. What's that? No, but there was a keyboard, electronic keyboard.
There is.
It's hard to play in zero gravity. But I spent a lot of time in my sleep station because there was some rough stuff going on. With my family, thanks to NASA. And so I prayed a lot. Now, Fyodor and Oleg and I, not so much, because it was kind of a cultural thing, but we spent a lot of quality faith crew time together, right? Where we knew each one of us had each other's back, and that we would listen to each other, and we would use each other to bounce and vent. I wasn't quite as good at that as people in the control center will tell you. I usually picked up the, hey, Houston, this is Clay on Space to Ground 2. What we did today was pretty stupid. You know, I was pretty vocal, and that got me in a lot of trouble, which meant I needed more private time. So.
Did it change you?
Yeah, space. Yeah. A lot of astronauts will tell you about the orbital perspective. Okay, that's the buzz phrase. You go to orbit, you get a new perspective. I totally get it. I totally agree with it, right? You see the Earth. It's the spaceship. We're all in the same spaceship. We're crewmates. I totally get that. The atmosphere is thin. We need to protect our planet. I totally get that. But what a lot of them don't do, and what I think is important, is what I tell folks is it did nothing but strengthen my faith in God. From the day I got there and looked out the window for the first time, it was like, oh my God, look. And you can't see it in a video, you can't see it in a photograph, and you hear astronauts say that all the time, but I'm telling you, they're exactly right. The color, I just freaked. But as I lived there for 152 days, the Earth is not random. The mountains are not random. The rivers in the mountains that go to the oceans are not random. The icebergs near Antarctica, none of that stuff to me is random. It all fits together, right? It just does. And all I could think of was, man, that is a powerful God. Because how many planets do we know with life on them? Just one. And Stephen Hawking, oh, we got to abandon Earth and go to Mars in 200 years. Do we really? No. God gave us a brain that's been developing since Cro-Magnon man was smacking things on the head with a big piece of wood. And that brain continues to develop. And we, I believe, if we work together and do the right thing, we'll figure out ways to sustain the human species on the only planet in our solar system, the only known planet in our galaxy, and the only known planet in our universe that has a species called humans. So that's my, it just increased my faith in God. I believe there's a God out there that somehow said, let there be light. And there was.
Will you maybe share your Columbus experience with us as...
Oh, sure. Speaking of faith.
Yeah, the capstone of the evening.
So every time there was a shuttle mission, you had family escorts. So the shuttle crew has so much to worry about, right, that they pick two or three astronauts to be escorts. And those astronauts begin pre-flight, before the mission, through the mission, and through landing to take care of every need that's conceivable by the crew commander and his crewmates. And so... for Columbia, out of the blue, I get a call from Rick Husband, the commander, and he says, Clay, I want you to be one of our family escorts. And I go, what? I've never been one. Never been asked to be one. I don't know why he asked me, unless he knew through talking to people that I was a person of faith, because he was a very faithful individual, and his crew had several people of faith. So I said, yes, absolutely, I'll be your family escort, having no idea what it meant. Well, I found out pretty fast, because his crew had the Israeli astronaut Ilan Ramon, and that meant when we got to the Cape, there were SWAT teams and FBI agents. I was paired with an FBI agent on everything, everywhere we went. And the first meeting we had was with the FBI. And so I went to the park. I walked their kids. I went down the slide with Elon's daughter, Noah. I fetched donuts for John Clark's son, Ian. I mean, you did whatever they wanted. You moved their bags. You just did it. And when they were in space, Steve Green came, the singer, who was a good friend of Rick Husband's. He came. I gave Steve Green, his guitar player and his sound guy, a tour of the Space Center. So everything's going great, right? And then on landing day, as a family escort, I'm at the Kennedy Space Center. I'm right in front of the grandstand where all the kids are playing. It's a beautiful day like today. They're throwing frisbees, running around in the grass, sitting in the grandstand. Everything was cool. Big clock ticking down, waiting for the two sonic booms. And I'm talking with Laurel Clark, who was one of the crewmates. I'm talking with her sister and Steve Lindsay, who was a shuttle commander and the lead family escort. And as we're standing there talking, I'm listening to the projection of the sound, right? And it doesn't sound right. Something's weird in that they call up and say, hey, UHF comm check, ultra high frequency, which we never do. Well, I listen a little bit, but I'm still talking to these people. And then I look over to the left where there's a snow fence. And all the VIPs, you know, the Congress people and the money people and not the family, are sitting in the bleachers. And there's a lady in a blue blazer, gray slacks, and a white shirt, the standard security uniform for KSC. And she has one of those big old black walkie-talkies. And she has the walkie-talkie up to her ear. And I look at her face, and I watch for just a few seconds, and her face turns white. And it was weird because I turned to look at Steve. And he looked at me and he said, get ready. That's all he said. And my stomach just went poof. Because, you know, ultra high frequency, no sonic booms, something's going on. So now they tell us we got to get everybody out. And that's when it starts to dawn on a trained shuttle crew member that something ain't right. Well, these poor families, where's everybody? We're supposed to, right? They're waiting to greet their family and we're putting them in a Suburban to drive them back to crew quarters. And then they came out later and told there's no hope. And I listened to kids scream and sob. And I picked up their bags, moved them around. And at the end of the long day, I finally got home. And my son was there. And my daughter and my wife, but the neighbors had helped protect my kids during the day because Sue knew something was going on. And I remember telling Sue, I need to go to church tomorrow. It was Saturday, and I just knew I needed to be there because I needed those people. And I still struggle with all that, you know. Did I do enough? I don't know. I'm sure I could have done more. But it's still with me today. And, of course, every year that they have the anniversary, it's a tough time for me. But the one thing that I remember from going to church that Sunday was that we went to Sunday school. And then, you know, I was pretty much a wreck. And there were reporters crawling all over, because Webster Presbyterian is the astronauts' church. I don't know if you know that, but it's where they all started, John Glenn and Buzz Aldrin, and all those guys went to church there in the early days. So there were reporters all over the place, and I'm in Sunday school and not handling things very well. But I remember somebody saying that if there was anyone they would think should have been there and was helpful to be there, they said it was you, me. So And so the fact that I was placed in that spot to do that job, and I still see the families occasionally, not quite as often, and they're recovering reasonably well, as much as can be expected. But I like to think that it was because of my faith that I was placed into that area, and I hope that as I grow old that my faith continues to be solid, and that, you know, maybe someday somebody will do that for me. So sorry about that. It's tough.
Thank you for sharing.
You bet.
How many were on that one?
7. Yeah. No, that's okay. It's easy to talk about numbers and stuff like that. It's the other stuff that gets me emotional. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think the technology today and the things that they're engineering, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, do you think that the space flight will be resumed at some point by U.S. government or U.S. private, and will it be safe?
Well, it'll be a combination. So it'll be, I don't think the billionaires. See, the problem people don't think about is someone's going to die again. It's statistically in the cards. And whether it's somebody on one of Elon's ships or somebody on Bezos' ship or this Virgin Galactic guy that's going to send Lady Gugu and Justin Bieber up there, you know, for $250,000, someone is going to buy the farm. And what I don't know is, will a guy like Elon, if it's his flight, will he stay the course, or will he just say, holy cow, I didn't realize it was going to be this hard and this dangerous? I mean, he kind of does. But until it slaps you in the face, you don't get it. So the astronaut office called me in about 3 months ago, because I was the last local guy that was a family escort for Columbia. And they wanted me to share my thoughts on the Columbia. Well, why did they want that? Why had they waited since 2003 to bring me back to talk to them? Well, it's because the Soyuz had just launched recently, right? You remember that one that aborted and they had to pop the top off and the two cosmonaut and the astronaut parachuted to safety and survived? And everybody said, oh my gosh, I'm so glad they're safe. And everybody was. But see, the astronaut office gets off on tangents and all this other cool stuff they're doing, and they don't stop to think about this issue that you might have to deal with. And so until it slaps you in the face, you typically don't want to address it. And I don't know how Elon or Jeff Bezos or Virgin Galactic or any of those guys are addressing this type of issue. Even Boeing, yeah. The Starliner, right? Who knows? Nobody's asked me. I won't charge them much to give them my input. But I mean, you know, so you see, will it be safe? It'll be safe to a certain level, but you can't make it infallible, no matter how much money you throw at it. And there isn't that much money, as we talked about before, so what does a guy like Elon do? He can't spend every dime he has trying to make it so safe that he can guarantee no one will ever die or be injured. So for me, that's kind of that's the game changer. But if all continues to go well, it'll be a commercial government venture. They'll be working somewhat together until Elon, knowing him as I perceive him, he'll think he's got it so wired he'll start to do this to the government because he doesn't need their money anymore. So, but that's my personal opinion. I don't speak for the government.
Any advice if our kids want to be astronauts?
Oh, man, go for it with everything you got. And not just astronaut, right? A lot of the guys in that picture we saw before, their life was planned to become an astronaut. They had no alternate. And what I would tell you is you want to teach your kids to dream, to persevere, right? To realize that whatever you do, you don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be the straight-A student. You don't want to get D's and F's. But if you get A's, B's, and C's, you're probably going to be okay. And then the fourth thing is to be proud of who you are. your faith, your home, your sexual preference, all that stuff. Be proud of who you are. Because if we teach our kids those four things, it won't matter if they're going to be a doctor, a teacher, an astronaut, a pro football player. It won't matter. Because we'll be giving them the tools they need to survive in this crazy world we live in that seems to be getting crazier every day. So that's what I'd challenge you to with your kids, is have that dream, and it could very well be astronaut. Persevere, realize you don't have to be a genius, and be proud of who you are. I think that's good advice for everybody.
Clay, thank you so much.
My pleasure, dear.
It's a huge personal favor, and you're just so wonderful, and we love you so much.
Thank you.
Quick about your new book coming out.
First of all, thank you for all who came and purchased books or looked at books.
And if you still want a book,
we can get you one.
We can get you a book.
Just see Doe. The cool thing is I have a fourth book, a second children's book coming out next year. Right now it's called Letters from Space, and it stars Astro Clay. And Astro Clay is drawn by Susan Batory, who's from Hungary, Budapest, Hungary. And apparently my wife gave a tour to the embassy of Budapest, or of Hungary, or parliament, and they all know who my illustrator is. They don't know who the hell I am.
It's pronounced like you would say Susan in Russian, so how would you...
Susan.
No, there's that little explosion letter.
Susan? I don't know.
It looks like Susan, but they don't say it that way.
Okay. But she's, the way it works, you know, I wrote the book, I turned it in, and they agreed to publish it, and then they go pick an illustrator. So I lucked out the first time and got this amazing guy, Scott Brundage. And then this time, they said her name's Susan, but whatever, Batory. And she sent me sketches, and it was like, wow, this is so cool. It's going to be a great children's book.
And we can follow you on Facebook.
Absolutely. Right? Astro Clay, Google Astro Clay, you'll get everything or way more than you ever wanted to know, probably. But there's access to the website, videos, lots of stuff. Sir?
You and your bride
meet. Oh.
Oh, yeah, see?
I can do it quickly. It's a good story. I was in the first floor of Building 30 at the Johnson Space Center, and it turns out we went to the JSC picnic, and I was the barker for the kids throwing the softball at the water tank dunk, okay? Well, I didn't know, but she was the person sitting on the dunk tank when I was inviting all these little kids that couldn't throw it hard enough to just run up and shove the snot out of it, so I'd dump her in the water. Well, I didn't know that. Well, then I was sitting in my office one day, and I saw this beautiful blonde woman walk by out the window. And I thought, whoa. And then I was in the cafeteria, the Building 11 cafeteria, and I was buying some stuff at the gift store and writing a check, and I see this beautiful blonde woman sauntering into the cafeteria, coming through the door. She walks by me, and I'm just like, whoa. So me being the stalker, apparently, that I am, she goes to the salad bar line and grabs her tray, and I slide in very adeptly with my tray right behind her in the salad bar line. And I haven't eaten. At that point in my life, I hadn't eaten a salad in forever. And so I'm very crafty in my methodology, and I try to look at her badge to get her name. And then I said something brilliant like, so you come here often?
Actually, what he said was, so you work, and he's looking at, you know, trying to read my badge and make eye contact. So you work in building, and I said,
pretty suave of me, wouldn't you agree? So then I follow her out. She goes and does her thing, and then I go run back to my office after lunch, and we had phone books back then. I don't know if you guys know what a phone book is. But I looked her name up because I had her name, right? I looked her name up. I call her on the telephone, and I get her secretary, who's a young man, and I said, hey, I'm calling for Susan Harold. And, well, she's not here right now. Can I take a message? Yes, would you tell her that Clay Anderson called? And here's my number, yada, yada, yada. I hear nothing for 2 weeks. And so I'm at home one night, lonely, bored, reading books. and we get the new little baby phone books delivered to us, right? And so I start going through it, looking for the names of females that I knew. And she was not my first choice. I mean, the first name I came across was this other gal, and then that didn't work out so well. So I called Susan, and I hung up on her answering machine until I finally got her live and asked her to lunch. So we went to Dos Mas Mexican food, and I can tell you what she was wearing that day.
I love that.
And the rest is history. And my sister-in-law, I asked her prior, if we have a good lunch, should I ask her out on another date, or should I wait? And my sister-in-law said, ask her out immediately. So I did.
And there you go.
And we're married 27 plus years, last November, so. Or this past November, yeah.
Last month. Well, Susan, thank you. We're so glad that you came as well. And thanks again, Clay.
Oh, my pleasure.